And now topic number two. On September 5, 1975, in Sacramento, California, a dress rehearsal was held for the assassination of our figurehead president, Gerald Ford. A young woman named Lynette Fromm got to within 2 feet of the president before being stopped by a Secret Service agent. As she was bundled off by the Secret Service with a look of horrified surprise on her face, she reportedly shouted, "It didn't go off." The very next day, the news media were filled with the entirely predictable conclusion of officials connected with the case. Miss Fromm, they assured us, had acted alone. The possibility of a conspiracy, that dirty word, was quickly poo-pooed and discounted. True, she had been given the gun by someone else, but that couldn't mean anything. And yes, her landlady did reportedly say that just lately, Miss Fromm has suddenly started paying her rent with $100 bills. But that can't be anything but coincidence. To give due credit to the officials involved, though, it should be mentioned that some of them did become predictably excited about one thing, namely the often stated need to disarm the populace under the banner of gun control. One official even ranted that this is so acute and so immediate as to call for, quote, wartime measures, unquote. Well, everybody, it so happens that the incident on September the 5th was not intended to injure President Ford. On July 17th and 18th, 1975, I said in a speech at the Santa Monica Civic Center in California, and I quote, "By September 1975, we will know if Rockefeller is to be stopped. Some very important developments are in the making," unquote. By this, I was referring to the all-out power struggle that is now going on, out of the public view, and the potentially decisive importance of this month, September 1975, in the Rockefeller timetable for dictatorship in America. This power struggle, though it is well hidden from the general public, is escalating to the vicious level of assassination politics, which burst onto the American scene 12 years ago with the murder of President John F. Kennedy. Assassinations have been a recurring part of the American scene ever since, including those of Dr. Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy, and recently Jimmy Hoffa, among others. And this volcano of violence threatens to erupt yet again now, as rival factions within and close to the Rockefeller camp jockey for position in the dictatorship now forming. Last month, by the way, in monthly audio letter number 3, I revealed for the first time the truth about how and why President Kennedy was killed. The response to my comments on that subject has been so overwhelming that I believe the following footnote is worth mentioning here. As you will recall, I revealed last month that President Kennedy was riding in an elaborately rigged limousine, the murder car. He was killed not by a sniper, but by a well-aimed blast from inside the car. That blast was, in all probability, set off by a radio signal from outside the car by someone in a position to tell just when to do it. My confidential technical sources now believe they know where the radio signal came from. If you have followed the various accounts that have come out about the JFK assassination over the years, you have probably heard of the mysterious man with the umbrella. This was an onlooker who was right on the scene of the shooting in Dallas. Reportedly, he abruptly raised his umbrella and opened it just as the president's car went by. And at that moment, the several snipers all began firing. After a few seconds, he is said to have closed the umbrella and put it back down, and the firing stopped. He then melted into the crowd and quickly vanished. Others have theorized that the man with the umbrella was the signalman who used the umbrella to coordinate the firing of the snipers for maximum confusion and effect. I believe this is correct. But based on my own confidential information, I believe he also had the additional role of sending the radio signal to set off the fatal blast inside the murder car at the height of the din from the snipers. The upraised umbrella would have made a perfect radio antenna to transmit the signal. And the signal itself could have been triggered with a button on the umbrella handle. It was important, though, to avoid focusing suspicion on the murder car itself, which was destroyed within 48 hours. Therefore, an ordinary umbrella looking like the one used by the mysterious onlooker was no doubt left somewhere nearby for people to find. While the real umbrella, equipped by the CIA with a tiny radio transmitter, was spirited away. When the ordinary look-alike umbrella was found, discarded on the scene, the natural reaction would be to say, "Look here, I guess the guy with the umbrella got rid of it so it wouldn't hamper his getaway." And that would be that. At any rate, we stand on the threshold of a possible new era of assassination, intimidation, and misinformation of the public even worse than that which followed the Kennedy assassination. The September 5th dress rehearsal for Ford's assassination was for two purposes. First, it was to give him a not-so-subtle hint that he had better fulfill his deal with Nelson Rockefeller and vacate the White House soon, or else. Second, it was staged on camera, you will notice, for the benefit of you and me, the public. This incident is a part of a multifaceted campaign to condition your mind to accept the departure of the Fords from the public scene one way or another. Witness, for example, how CBS, which is thoroughly under the thumb of the Rockefellers, set up Betty Ford as a clay pigeon on the August 10, 1975 CBS television show 60 Minutes. There, Betty Ford bared her private life and thoughts in public in a way which has brought down ridicule and shame on her head. In this and many other ways, the Fords are being belittled in the public mind so that our first appointed president won't be missed when he is replaced by our second. Yes, the behind-the-scenes power struggle, which has so far kept Nelson Rockefeller from seizing the presidency, which he had planned to do by June, 3 months ago, is beginning to erupt into the open. What we are witnessing is the latest phase of an elaborate multi-step coup d'etat, with its major milestones spaced roughly a year apart, so that public apprehensions will largely die out between steps. Just over 3 years ago, the coup d'etat began with a Broadergate break-in. 2 years ago, Vice President Spiro Agnew was eliminated from the scene. This activated the 25th Amendment, which Nelson Rockefeller had manipulated into a constitution several years before, to be used in the planned coup. Just over 1 year ago, Richard Nixon became the first president in American history to resign, the victim of Watergate, which was conceived by Nelson Rockefeller, engineered by his CIA, and given a final assist in the form of blackmail by Nelson Rockefeller's longtime agent, Henry Kissinger. Now it has been another year, and it is time for the next step, namely, the ousting of figurehead Gerald Ford from the White House, so that our president, in fact, Nelson Rockefeller, can make himself president in name also. And Rockefeller must do this soon, because he is becoming more and more unpopular by the day. If this is accomplished according to plan, the coup d'etat itself will be complete. After that, there will only be one step left to go: our ratification of Nelson Rockefeller's status as our dictator on Election Day, November 1976, just over 1 year from now. On that day, we are to return our then incumbent president, Nelson Rockefeller, to the White House. And at the same time, we are to accept by national referendum the new Rockefeller Constitution, which has already been written and which will give him a 9-year term as our first dictator. Every possible avenue is being pursued in order to pave the way for this bicentennial death of our republic. Not the least of these preparations involve the conditioning of your mind through the massive controls over the mass media exercised by the Rockefellers. For example, various component provisions embodied in the secret new Constitution keep popping up here and there, seemingly at random, but actually as parts of a well-coordinated master public relations war being waged on the unsuspecting American public by the Rockefellers. To cite just one example, and they are everywhere these days, if your eyes are open, there is the article in a recent issue of Business Week entitled, quote, "The Big New Push for Federal Chartering of Corporations," unquote. Business Week, as should be mentioned, is published by McGraw-Hill, one of the hundreds of major companies under Rockefeller control. McGraw-Hill is a particularly useful voice for the Rockefellers, since it publishes a series of special industry magazines which established high prestige long ago and are therefore very influential now. Anyway, the article says that there is a rapidly emerging push to replace state chartering of corporations in America by federal chartering, and that surprisingly, some of the most powerful backing for this move is coming from leaders of major corporations themselves, such as General Electric. The article fails to point out, though, that all these big corporations cited are Rockefeller outfits, and federal chartering is one of the keystones of the corporate socialist economic structure spelled out in the new Rockefeller Constitution. The impetus for this big new federal chartering campaign is stated to be a couple of Supreme Court decisions which may look, quote, conservative, unquote, on their face, since they effectively removed the federal influence over corporations that had long been exerted through Rule 10b-5 of the Securities Exchange Commission. This ruling looks at first glance to be a move away from federal meddling, but its actual purpose is to whip up sentiment in Congress to pass legislation which will go much further than the old SEC rule. This is a perfect example, in which the real purposes of political actions is the exact opposite of the surface appearance. And if anyone doubts that the Supreme Court is knowingly being guided to do the Rockefeller will, just consider, for example, our Chief Justice Warren Earl Burger. One of the ways in which he established the credentials which led to his Supreme Court appointment was through his contribution as a so-called outside expert to the writing of the secret new Rockefeller Constitution. The idea to eliminate the right of trial by jury, which the new Constitution does, came from Burger. The art of politics, as it is practiced at the national level today in America, has been reduced to continual deception and trickery. A perfect example is the plan which has been concocted by Nelson Rockefeller and his longtime friend and supporter, George Meany, to recast Rockefeller's image in a conservative mold. Imagine. This has become necessary because it is now the conservatives who hold the balance of political power in America. No doubt you've noticed the wide publicity which has been given lately to the supposedly conservative views which are preached by Nelson Rockefeller these days in his speeches. Never mind that his entire public career for more than 40 years is a sordid history of well-documented but little-known piracy against the American ship of state. Never mind that he has always espoused, quote, fiscal integrity, unquote, and that without exception this has been translated into higher taxes, increasing public debt, swelling unemployment, and mushrooming welfare rolls. And never mind that his public career is littered with broken promises and double crosses. He now says things which the Rockefeller-controlled news media label conservative, so we are to take them at face value. But many Americans will not be taken in by Rockefeller's own statements alone. So going along now on a parallel road as a fellow traveler is one George Meany. Meany has lately made a great show of not letting the longshoreman in his AFL-CIO load wheat bound for Russia, supposedly until the American consumer is protected against inflation and whatnot. This stand has been painted in the news media as evidence of conservatism on his part, but now that this political harvest has been reaped, the grain is being loaded once again and sent on its way to Rockefeller's Mother Russia. Just to enhance this conservative image, Meany is also throwing snide remarks at Henry Kissinger. Kissinger has now done his job for Rockefeller and is about to be thrown to the wolves so as to appease the conservatives and to fool them into thinking they are gaining ground. Thus, Meany is building a conservative anti-communist image as fast as possible. And since he is not a self-serving politician, this apparent development of a conservative streak will be taken by many as genuine. He will therefore be in a perfect position when the time is ripe to throw his arm around Nelson Rockefeller and give him his full political support. Rockefeller will thus be transformed into an instant conservative, anti-communist, anti-Soviet in the eyes of many trusting Americans. One of the most diabolically clever and cruel twists in this plan has been the way in which Nelson Rockefeller, through his agent George Meany, used exiled Russian author Alexander Solzhenitsyn to further his own political plans. Very few Americans grasp what happened, and Solzhenitsyn himself has no inkling at all
of the treachery that surrounded his recent visit to the United States. Solzhenitsyn is a true and great Russian patriot who has suffered terrible things at the hands of the imperialist communist regime that now enslaves his people. He would never have knowingly permitted himself to be used by the very people who perpetually finance and sustain the Russian communist police state. But he did not reckon with the craftiness of the Rockefeller brothers. Meany said in his introduction to one of Solzhenitsyn's speeches under AFL-CIO sponsorship that Solzhenitsyn is, quote, a voice that demands to be heard, a voice that will not be denied, unquote. The Rockefeller approach to anything they cannot suppress is to harness it, and that is what they did to Solzhenitsyn. They harnessed him. First, the United States government agreed with Russia not to accord him any official recognition before he was released. Hence the widely publicized snub by President Ford. Next, George Meany latched onto him even before he came out of Russia and sewed up a commitment from the famous Russian exile to speak under AFL-CIO auspices in the United States. Then when he reached America, his great AFL-CIO speaking tour consisted of only two speeches, one in Washington, D.C., and the other in New York City. As a result, Solzhenitsyn's actual words, which I believe every American should hear, were heard by very few people. But the fact that he had spoken under George Meany's sponsorship was publicized nationwide in the Rockefeller news media, and this explains why the New York Times gave it broad coverage. The net result, a few people heard the truth from Solzhenitsyn, but vast numbers of people were deceived by all this into thinking George Meany deserves the conservative label now being stuck to him by the Rockefeller public relations machine. A more convincing lie would be difficult to imagine. I now turn briefly to topic number 3. In my monthly audio letter number 3 last month, I revealed that major revisions are in the works for upcoming war plans. These changes stem from the actions of Indira Gandhi to stop the Rockefeller takeover of India by way of their CIA. The Rockefellers want to absorb India into their empire before proceeding to World War III and are therefore modifying their foreign intrigues accordingly. Their plans I revealed some time ago for World War III, which is really to be half a world war with America as the main battleground, have not been abandoned altogether. They have simply been put on a back burner while the focus shifts to India, which is the last remaining chunk of the old British Empire that is not yet in Rockefeller hands. The emerging build-up to war in Asia, which is now targeted to start about March 1977, according to the Rockefeller plans, is a complex thing and is being largely ignored by most observers right now. I plan to speak more about it in upcoming audio letters, but I feel you should have at least a thumbnail sketch now. To begin with, the Helsinki Accord, signed recently by Ford, Brezhnev, and leaders of more than 30 other nations, had only one real effect. It formally ratified Russian conquests in Eastern Europe, regardless of all the official protestations to the contrary. That's why Soviet Party boss Brezhnev had tears of joy in his eyes after all had signed it. It gave Russia a secure border in Western Europe, and the ink was hardly dry when Russian attention turned eastward to China. Well-orchestrated attacks on Peking and the foreign policy of Chairman Mao have appeared not only in high-level organs of the Soviet press, but also in Soviet satellites such as East Germany, Bulgaria, and others. Russia fears that China might become the leader of the third world of developing nations. Therefore, Russia is trying to encircle China and has been greatly helped in recent years by the Kissinger foreign policy, which has handed over Southeast Asia to Russia, not to China, as some people think, and which has effectively neutralized American influence elsewhere along the Chinese encirclement perimeter. The encirclement threat to China, in turn, is giving impetus to the forging of a Sino-Japanese axis, which is forming right now. Finally, this whole situation and its tensions are such that the Rockefellers hope and expect to turn it to their own purposes. Through their thorough control of Japan, an avenue is readily available to guide events toward precipitation of the planned war against India on schedule. This is especially so since John D. Rockefeller III, the real ruler of Japan today, learned all about such things long ago when he helped maneuver the Japanese into attacking Pearl Harbor. Finally, once India is attacked, Russia will enter on India's side, and America will be used as a factory to supply Russia. The Rockefellers stand to make lots of money through their involvement on both sides, as usual, and they expect to pick up the pieces in India after the smoke clears. And so, my friends, on and on it goes, unless we stop it. More and more people are now asking, what can I do? I plan to say more about this in the future, but let me just give you these brief hints for now, if I may. First, you must inform yourself. Know what is going on, so you will know what needs to be corrected. Second, inform others, and never think anything is too small to do. Talk to a friend, a neighbor. Write a letter to the editor. Third, put pressure on your elected officials, locally and at the state level, as well as Congress. Call or write again and again and again and again until they learn you mean business and cannot be shrugged off with routine, polite, meaningless replies. Finally, be specific about what you want your elected officials to do to straighten things out. In this regard, I strongly recommend that you focus your energies on the Fort Knox gold scandal. Those who have perpetrated this fantastic crime and cover-up are now running scared behind the scenes. The Fort Knox affair is the one most dangerous issue for the conspirators who are trying to trap us all in a dictatorship. So do all you can to help us break it into the open so that the truth can be proven. Until next month, then, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and God bless each and every one of you.